This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with the founder of the Electronic Intifada, Ali Abunima.
What can we and the Egyptians look forward to, and what will happen in Palestine?
We'll also talk with NYU Middle Eastern expert Professor Zachary Lachman.
Professor Lachman analyzes the protests in Egypt and attributes much of it to the cracking of the neoliberal empire.
Stay with us.
Heidi, you know, New York City, and of course around the country, but in New York City, the ones I'm familiar with, there's been a lot of police shootings of civilians, and almost never do you get any accountability for what the cop did. And now, really, in an important ruling, we have a judge in New York who apparently is trying to get to the bottom of a lot of these police shootings. Can you tell us what happened?
Last week, Justice Emily Jane Goodman of Manhattan ordered the New York Police Department to hand over more than a decade's worth of internal reports that detail police shootings of civilians. She gave them 60 days to release reports that they've been compiling since 1997 to the New York Civil Liberties Union, which has been trying to get the information for about 4 years, showing you how slowly the wheels of justice turn in New York when it relates to the police department.
You know, this is interesting because, you know, I just came by a poster the other day. They're all over New York. People know them, and probably other states. You know, $10,000 reward for evidence that leads to the arrest and conviction of anybody who shoots a cop. Well, I was thinking the alternative campaign should be a $10,000 reward for any evidence that leads to the arrest and conviction of any cop who shoots a civilian. But I wonder if they would even let us get those posters up. But that's the one I want to do. And maybe Emily Jane Goodman's decision will help us understand and get to the bottom of police killings.
The NYPD had denied previous requests for the internal reports because it said that personnel records were exempt from the state's Freedom of Information law.
Nice. Even if the guy pulled out his gun and shot a civilian, it doesn't make any sense. That's like saying they have a license to break the law.
Yeah, no, that's discoverable information when you sue them under the civil rights law.
Just one more point about these cases. The New York Police Department actually turned over the personnel records that they are now saying should not go to the New York Civil Liberties Union to the Rand Corporation after Sean Bell was shot.
Why did they do that?
They wanted the Rand Corporation, I guess, to conduct a study of the department's firearm training. These are not, should not be confidential records.
Right. The point is the city feels they can turn them over to people when they want, but when someone who wants to really do something that may be adverse to the police.
Exactly. They, and we know the Rand Corporation is going to write a favorable report for the police department.
Of course. In a related development, Michael, the Center for Constitutional Rights has put up this huge ad in Times Square in the Jumbotron.
What's a Jumbotron?
It's like a television set the size of a football field.
And this one happens to sit in the middle of the crossroads of the world, Times Square, on top of what was the old Times building, right in the middle, the early one Times Square. When you come down the street, you see this huge, huge screen. The story isn't really about the screen in Times Square. The story is about the Center for Constitutional Rights' case to get the New York City statistics on all of the stop and frisks they do of citizens in New York, people in New York going about their business. And of course, over the last few months, the center has got documents from the city that says that some 650,000 people are stopped on an annual basis by the New York City cops, in which they're oftentimes searched. And of course, it turns out that the majority of blacks and Latinos stopped and searched is way beyond their number in the actual population of New York City. So this is an obvious discriminatory method of, quote, enforcing the law. It shouldn't be happening. And so what the center did was they decided we need to build up not just a lawsuit, we need to build up public support for how outrageous this is. So if you go into Times Square, you will see on the Jumbotron, every few minutes, I'm not sure how often it plays, the picture and the ad opposing police stop and frisks around this city, particularly because they're done in a discriminatory manner.
The Guild and CCR just had a joint victory in reaching a settlement in Virginia where our joint publication, the Jailhouse Lawyer Handbook, which helps inmates bring what are called Section 1983 lawsuits against prison officials, that had been banned in at least one facility in that state.
It's remarkable. You know, the Guild, National Lawyers Guild, and the Center have been distributing the Jailhouse Handbook, I think, since I was a kid, almost. I mean, it goes
a different
through,
version.
Right. It goes through many revisions.
Right.
And now it's quite an extensive handbook that is mailed out free to any prisoner who asks for it. And you can get that, I think, I know, through the Center and through the Guild as well.
Right.
And they have a project. So if people want that book. But what's amazing is they banned it in the Virginia prisons. And it's a self-help book that explains the court system, methods for legal research, summarizes constitutional rights. And, of course, it doesn't have any material in it that would somehow cause a security concern that would allow a prison to ban it. And yet, the Virginia prison system, in its great knowledge and its great wisdom, decided to ban the book. And then the Center and the Guild went to court to try and get the book back into the prisons, and the state caved, which, of course, what was the choice? I mean, it was ridiculous. But it just shows how petty and outrageous these prison systems are.
Part of the settlement requires that the Virginia Department of Corrections make available 5 copies of the current Jailhouse Lawyer Handbook and a new version, which we're releasing later this year, in all prison libraries. So
Beautiful.
That individuals who haven't asked us for it will still have access to it in their libraries. Also, inmates in special housing units, which are restrictive units, as our listeners know, who don't have access to the law library must receive a notice alerting them to the availability of the handbook. The settlement also includes compensation for damages, which are pretty minimal, as well as attorney's fees.
And just remember, Virginia is the home of Mount Vernon, George Washington's fine estate where he kept slaves. And just also remember that when we were still young, there was a case called Loving v. Virginia, which was the case that finally held unconstitutional Virginia's law against a term maybe some of you aren't familiar with, miscegenation, which is marriage between blacks and whites, or mixed race, supposedly. But it was held unconstitutional, and that's Loving v. Virginia. So Virginia continues in its great tradition of denying fundamental rights to human beings.
Michael, on a lot of police procedural TV shows, I noticed that one of the things they use a lot are tracking devices, so that when an agent goes undercover, they have his safety at hand by knowing where his car goes. But we have a case that is a little more real life and perhaps much more disturbing.
Well, we've covered on the show a lot about what's happening to Muslims in California. There was a recent lawsuit just started against informants in mosques, and a particular informant who was just widely going through mosques and reporting to the FBI. And the latest one is a 20-year-old young man named Yasser Afifi, from Santa Clara, California, who discovered a secret GPS tracking device in his car. And he didn't really know what it was. What happened is he took his car in to be repaired or the oil changed. The device had been placed like in the engine or in the engine box or somewhere near the engine, and had a little antenna, and the mechanic said, "What's this?" Took it out, and there's a picture of it on the web. You can go and find it. It looks like something probably about the size of 2 packs of cigarettes end to end. And the young man didn't know what it was, and he put a picture of it apparently up on the web to say, "What's this?" And of course, immediately people got in and said, "This is a GPS tracking device." And then he kept it at home. And then the FBI, a few days later, knocks on his door and says, "You're holding government property. It's very expensive government property, and you have to give it back to us." So then the kid says, "Well, what's this?" "This is because I wouldn't talk to you, right?" And they won't say. But, of course, apparently the kid had refused to talk to the FBI. He's not guilty of a thing. He's a young man
How
in college.
How old is he?
20 years old.
Okay.
And they take back the GPS tracking device. Well, this week, the man and CARE, the Muslim group, filed an action against the FBI for putting this tracking device on this man's car. Now, the question is, what's the legality of these things? From what I understand is there's been a number of court decisions, but 3 of them, including one in the Ninth Circuit where this man is, which is out in California, have gone in favor of the FBI, have said they don't need a search warrant or a warrant to place a tracking device on your car on the theory that if your car is driving down the street, anybody can see it. But that's absurd, because what the tracking device does is track the car wherever it goes. So it's not that anybody, when they see your car go by, can then say, "Oh, you're going to Michael's house, and then from there you're going to Heidi's house, and from there you're going to the mosque." That's not what they can see. So the whole decision is crazy. There's been 3 bad decisions. There's been 1 good decision.
And where was the good decision?
I think out of D.C. out of the East, which said, look, this is different. When you track a person for a long time, they're not saying for a day, you're getting everything about them, and you can't do that. Another interesting aspect of it that came up when we were younger in cases is when you did wiretaps, you oftentimes had to enter a person's house to do it. Is that legal? And of course, in this case, one of the tracking devices, they actually went onto the driveway in one of these cases of a private house and put the tracking device on. They still said that was okay, which is an outrage to me, actually.
Except, Michael, I can see that argument being related to being able to search through a garbage can, which is also on the front lawn, and we know that that's a lawful search.
Garbage can is just beyond what they call the curtilage. If you put your garbage out on the street in New York or in front of your house, from the sidewalk to the street, that's considered joint property, essentially, and you're considered to have abandoned it. And they can make trash covers and trash searches of that. If you put it up on the driveway on the other side of the sidewalk, or in New York City, like behind the iron fence if it's a house, then they can't do that. That would be a violation of the Fourth Amendment. They shouldn't be able to go on your property to place a bumper beeper. Now, one of the reasons I raised this whole issue is because when I was a lawyer in the 70s, we found a bumper beeper on a car of Margie Ratner and Bill Kunstler. And we found it on the back bumper. And it was like about 10 inches long and about 2.5 inches wide, all black. We took it off the car. It was held by a magnet. And we had an office down on Broadway, and we had a big safe, maybe, I would say the safe was 4 feet high, 5 feet, 4 feet high, maybe 2 feet wide, very heavy. And we put the bumper beeper in the safe. And then we began to commence a lawsuit on it. Within a few days of the bumper beeper going into the safe, the FBI, we're pretty sure, came into the office and they stole the entire safe. Gone. So they took it. That happened in the 70s, so this time they at least knocked on the door and took it from the kid. Our lawsuit turned out to be successful, and eventually the cops settled. But again, it was an issue of a bumper beeper. So check your cars if you think you might be in jeopardy. Have your mechanic do it. Apparently this one was installed badly, so the antenna went up. And also, a former FBI agent went online about the current bumper beeper and said, well, that's an old-fashioned one a little bit because it needs a battery. The newer ones are much smaller. They have a very tiny little power source and can be hidden much more secretly.
I wonder if now, if you found a beeper, did not turn it over, if they could bring charges against you for holding property that wasn't yours.
I don't think so, because they'd have to prove that you knew that it was theirs.
Well, they would inform you. They would tell you. They would send you a note and say, you have our property. That's what they did in this case. That's the government property.
Well, I tell them, I'm holding a press conference. Come to the press conference and I'll give it back to you.
Yeah, of course. You'd do something like that. But I do think, Heidi, that that a court might say they have a right to recover it, especially if they would go into court and say, well, its mechanism is secret, how we do it is secret, and you're holding not only government property, but secret property.
It makes you wonder how many individuals have these unknown to them on their cars.
And just remember this about cell phones. We've talked about what happened in the kidnapping in Milan to Abu Omar, how the Italian magistrate tracked down the CIA people. They did it with the use of cell phones. And when I say use, I use that term not in a real use. You can have your cell phone, and if it's turned on, it's always sending signals to the nearest cell tower, and they can track it wherever it goes. If you don't want to be tracked, turn off your cell phones. But even that may not be good enough. When I talk to people, they now, in the newest cell phones, have an extra little power source that the government has required them to put in. So the only way to actually stop surveillance of your cell phone, at least location-wise, is to not only take out the battery, but take out the SIM card. And then they're finished. Uprisings continue to sweep through the Middle East, from Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, Bahrain, Yemen, Iran, and Iraq. Similar demonstrations have caught fire in Wisconsin. Economic hardship, desperate living conditions are partly the cause for some of these mass protests. In one article describing the Wisconsin protests, the journalist wrote, "There were many voices this last month that raised the cry, 'We are all Egyptians.'" Governments are said to be scrambling to squelch popular dissent. How will these protests begin to reshape countries in the Middle East? And what government structures are standing by to replace these decadent tyrannies and corrupt monarchies? Also, how are Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank responding to the massive dissent and uprisings in nearby Arab countries? Today we're joined by Ali Abu Nima to discuss some of these questions. Ali is the author of One Country, a bold proposal to end the Israeli-Palestinian impasse, and a co-founder of the Electronic Intifada.
So we're really pleased to have you on Law and Disorder, especially to give us some perspective on what's happening in the Middle East and, of course, particularly in Israel and Palestine right now. You and I were in Egypt a year ago when it was a very different place, when we tried to get into Gaza. What is it now, and how do you see this unraveling?
Well, the events over the past 2 months have certainly been momentous and historic, and we still don't know how they're all going to play out. This started in Tunisia, it spread to Egypt, now it's in Libya. More generally, we have uprisings and movements for democracy and rights in a number of Arab countries, including in Jordan, where I just was till last week. When you and I were in Egypt a year ago, we were in Tahrir Square, and that patch of ground became familiar to us during the Gaza Freedom March. It was really hard to imagine the extent of the changes only a year or so later, but it's still playing out. I think the aspirations of Tunisians, Egyptians, Libyans, Jordanians, Palestinians are very clear. I think what remains to be seen is whether they will succeed in completing and protecting their revolutions, if we can call them that, because there is certainly a strong counter-revolutionary push, not just from old regime elements that are still in place, whether in Egypt or Tunisia, but also from the United States, which sees its own hegemony in the Middle East under threat and crumbling as these dictatorships start to come down. And they have been such important pillars for U.S. and Israeli hegemony in the region.
Ali, what are the forces in play in Egypt, and what's their relationship? And part of that's, you know, the much grander question is, how do they whittle down the strength of the army?
Well, that's a good question. And the mass uprising was perhaps sudden, but the important thing to know is that there were Egyptian activists risking their lives for many, many years to lay the ground for the uprising that happened. And I think that they are the ones who made it possible for Tahrir Square and for the uprising to happen. And they're the ones whose continued work is going to ensure that the goals of the revolution are actually implemented, because right now we see the army is still in charge. The Egyptian army itself was very much tied to the old regime, to the upper echelons. The upper echelons of the army are fully implicated in the old regime. The interim government that the army swore in just in the past few days contains many ministers of the last government that Mubarak appointed. Although they've brought in opposition parties, these were opposition parties that were more or less aligned with the regime to begin with. So ultimately, and at the same time, you have now a parade of American and other officials going to Egypt who will be trying to minimize any shift in Egypt's regional position away from the Israeli-American axis and into a more independent orbit, let's say. So these are all forces that are working against the success of a revolution in Egypt. Ultimately, I think the only guarantee is the continued mobilization of the Egyptian people, of Egyptian workers who have been striking to improve their conditions, to change the conditions that they've been working and living under for so many years. And that ultimately is the only protection for the gains that have been made and making sure that the next goals and objectives are achieved, which is a fully democratic Egypt under the control of its people and independent in the region in terms of the major regional geopolitics.
I understand what you're saying, particularly because the U.S. is still giving $1.3 billion at least to the Egyptian army. And what do you do with that problem? I mean, here you're sitting there in the Egyptian army and you're getting $1.3 billion from the United States, or roughly that. And the U.S. is going to be saying, you don't do what we want, goodbye. I mean, I don't know. I'm just looking at from a distance.
Well, that, you know, I think that this is going to take time to play out. I don't think it was ever realistic to expect instant changes in Egypt's alignments and regional policies, although we already saw one significant thing, which is the passage of Iranian warships through the Suez Canal, which displeased Israel and the United States very much. But I think that's an important indicator of, you know, Egypt saying, well, you know, we have a treaty which guarantees the passage of the ships of any country with which we're not at war, and Iran is such a country. So that's one sign. But there have to be others. One of the myths that has been propagated in American media is that this revolution or this uprising is entirely about internal domestic issues. Well, there were millions of people in Tahrir Square last Friday, Victory Friday as they called it, and one of their demands was reopening the Rafah crossing. When we were in Cairo for the Gaza Freedom March, our goal was to get through Rafah into Gaza, and we didn't succeed in that because of the Egyptian regime's complicity with the Israeli and American blockade and siege of Gaza. So Rafah is supposed to be open now, but it needs to be reopened permanently, the situation on the border normalized, and the siege end. That will be an important indicator. But, you know, there are models. Turkey is a country that was very closely aligned with the United States, dependent on it militarily in terms of technology, NATO membership, ideological alignment. But starting in 2003, we started to see a decisive shift when Turkey refused to allow the United States to use its territory to launch the invasion of Iraq. But Turkey has remained integrated, fully integrated in NATO. At the same time, it has a quite independent regional foreign policy. So these are things that are not impossible to square. But ultimately, if you have an Egyptian democracy, then I think it's impossible to imagine Egypt continuing with the same kinds of pro-Israeli and American-aligned policies that we've seen in recent years. That will change, though it may take time to play out.
Now, you anticipated my next question, Ali. What is the Israeli establishment saying about, and how are they responding to the developments in Egypt? I can't imagine that they're happy about the democratic thrust of the Egyptian developments.
Well, utter panic. And on the Electronic Intifada a few days ago, we published a really nice piece by Professor Ilan Pappé looking at the reaction in Israel. And it's a piece I strongly recommend. The title of the piece was Bad for the Jews, which was a title. But that was actually a quote from a former Israeli ambassador to Egypt who said that, you know, the fall of Mubarak is bad for the Jews.
Right.
Of course, he meant bad for Israel.
Bad for Israel, bad for Zionists, but not bad for the two Jews who are interviewing you right now. Good for us.
And that's exactly the point that Ilan Pappé was making, which is that, in fact, these regional changes are actually good for Jews and good for Israelis to be in a region where people are fighting for universal rights, for democracy, for human rights, is ultimately good for Israelis and good for Jews, and is really the only way they have a long-term future in the region, rather than as an exceptional settler colonial state practicing apartheid as Israel is today. So there's a kind of strategic shock in Israel that has been expressed at sort of every level, military and civilian. And really it reveals the complacency with which Israel had come to rely on the kind of thuggery and dictatorship and complicity of Mubarak and Egypt to commit so many of its crimes. The war in Gaza probably could not have been carried out without Egyptian complicity. Remember the famous picture of Tzipi Livni, the then Israeli foreign minister, with her Egyptian counterpart, Ahmed Abul Ghait, the 2 days before the attack on Gaza on December 25th, 2008. They were photographed together in Cairo holding hands, a picture that really came to symbolize for people what was wrong. Of course, the worrying thing is that Ahmed Abulghait is still the foreign minister of Egypt. So we still haven't seen that full transformation, I think, that needs to happen.
Ali, what concerns me, getting back to the point you made before about the upper echelons of the Egyptian army, is that these guys are filthy rich, that they became economic players as well as military players in Egyptian society. And I wanted to ask you about that.
That's right. The Egyptian military is said to control huge segments of the Egyptian economy. I remember, I don't know if you remember, driving into Cairo from the airport along the road from Heliopolis, you see these huge, huge offices clubs. I mean, just huge compounds, luxury facilities for the top echelons of the army. And these really symbolize the kind of privileged place the military has in Egypt. So there's every reason to worry, but you know, ultimately it's up to the Egyptian people to guarantee their revolution, to hold the army accountable, and to make sure that the transition that they're demanding happens. And that I think is what it comes down to.
This is another question going back to Palestine and Israel. And you know, obviously when we saw Egypt, my great hope was that the Gaza siege blockade is going to be over from at least that side of the border. But I'm also interested in what's happening within Palestine right now. And of course, we're seeing that Palestinian Authority has called for new elections. I think that's right. Hamas says this is not right. We're you know, you haven't consulted with us, et cetera, et cetera. But can you give us some sense of what's going on and how this has affected what's happening within Palestine?
Yes, it does affect there's two things. One is Palestine is part of the region and is being affected by what's happening. But there's also some things that are specific to Palestine, and they're all coming to a head together. One is the complete death of the so-called peace process. It's dead, dead, dead. It is never coming back. It's very hard for me to imagine at this point George Mitchell getting back to the same old game of coming and talking about proximity talks and all that. I think that's finished. I'm not saying that the Obama administration isn't delusional enough to try it, but it will just absolutely go nowhere. So the death of the peace process, the Palestine papers, which were revealed by Al Jazeera, and I had some part in that, in that I'd been invited to come and look at them before Al Jazeera went public with them, I think have killed it. And then the broader crisis of legitimacy of all the regimes affects the Palestinian Authority and the Palestinian leadership as well. So they're desperate to try to find new legitimacy, and so that's why they called elections. I don't think those elections will take place, and I don't think that such elections can restore legitimacy. Why? Because what we have learned, if anything, over the past 5 years, is that you actually cannot have a functioning democracy and normal politics under Israel's occupation. And the elections that were held in 2006, which Hamas won, the result was not respected. Dozens of elected officials were simply jailed by the Israelis because Israel didn't like them. We saw the United States backing one side and essentially fomenting a contra-style civil war within the occupied Palestinian territories. And so that game is also finished. I don't think elections will happen. But one of the exciting possibilities is that, you know, Palestinians, or let's put it this way, Tunisians, Egyptians, Libyans, although they face a particularly brutal regime, have shown that traditional leadership structures are not necessarily a prerequisite for liberation, for transformation. So we see a whole huge amount of decentralized but very focused activism around Palestine, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, the populist struggle within Palestine, among Palestinian citizens of Israel, and so on, that has clear goals, but doesn't necessarily have centralized leadership. And maybe that's a model that works in the 21st century, and Palestinians should simply dissolve the Palestinian Authority and allow that leadership to develop from below.
Ali Abu Nima, I want to just take a moment to put in a plug for the Electronic Intifada. Please tell our listeners how they can get a hold of your site.
Well, they should go to electronicintifada.net, and they will see an incredibly rich amount of original reporting and analysis put together by the incredible team that we have, and contributed by writers pretty much everywhere in the world. And it's we work hard every day to publish this resource, and we have great people working on it and thousands of people who read it every day. So if you're not one of them, come to the site and see what it's all about.
And I'm sure our listeners can tell just by listening to this remarkable interview what that site is like, and it is fabulous. We have our last question, Ali. You and I were together, I said, a little over a year ago in Egypt. You know, it was a very different world then. Does this give you great hope for the future? I mean, how does it make you feel seeing this transformation that's going on?
It does give me great hope. I let me say, I always had that hope, but you never know when the moment will come when things come together. And I think it reminds us, as other moments in history have, that changes, great transformations, are not always announced in advance. We saw that with the fall of the Berlin Wall, with the end of apartheid in South Africa. And it gives me hope that really an end to apartheid in Palestine, Israel, and justice and equality for all the people who live there is a perfectly reasonable goal. It's one that we can achieve in the next 2 years. It also gives me hope that we can see the kinds of movements that we need in this country to bring the changes we need here. You know, you're seeing that now with mass movements in Madison, Wisconsin, where a lot of people are saying, we're inspired by what's happening in Egypt. At the same time that people in Tunisia are and Egypt is throwing off repressive security states, people in this country are fighting against increasing repression of activists, anti-war activists, human rights workers by the FBI and the Justice Department. And we need to make those connections that your rights are not given to you from above. You have to fight for them. And I think that's the message I think that is truly universal, whether you're in Madison, Wisconsin, or Chicago, Illinois, or in Cairo. That's a message I think we can all take away from this.
Well, Ali Abu Nima from the Electronic Intifada, thank you so much for being with us. I know you've been working on this stuff for years, and it's great to talk to you. Thank you, Ali.
Thank you, Ali.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Ripple through the Middle East, with some of the biggest anti-government demonstrations yet in Bahrain. Meanwhile, the protests in Libya have turned deadly as the regime's military has killed hundreds of demonstrators. New York University professor of Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies and History, Zachary Lachman, joins us with an analysis on the mass protests in Egypt. Lachman says the old political parties have no credibility. Professor Lockman is the author of many books, including Contending Visions of the Middle East, The History and Politics of Orientalism, and Explorations in the Field, Lost Voices and Emerging Practices in Egypt, 1882 to 1914. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
My pleasure to be here.
Zach, what are the social forces at play in Egypt right now?
Well, first of all, one of the most interesting things going on is the huge explosion of strikes and demonstrations by workers. And this has a long background, and it's really the background to the uprising of the last couple of weeks. There was a huge explosion of strikes and protests going back to 2008. If you remember, one of the leading groups which launched the demonstrations on January 25th called itself the April 6th Youth Movement. Called itself that because on April 6, 2008, there was supposed to be a big general strike, especially of textile workers, for higher wages and better working conditions. But inevitably, for Egyptian workers, like for everybody else in Egypt, economics and politics are inseparable. And any strike, any demand for an independent trade union was inevitably ran up against the security forces. So there's a tremendous demand among Egyptians, which helped fuel the uprising, continues to fuel the movement in the streets, for some kind of change to the neoliberal economic policies which the Mubarak regime implemented beginning 20-odd years ago, and which the guys in charge of Egypt, the generals, don't have any desire to change.
When you say neoliberal, talk about how that unfolded and who got rich and who got poor.
Sure. So, Egypt back in the 50s and 60s under the Nasser government carried through a series of social reforms. For example, the largest estates held by the large landowners were broken up, and millions of landless peasants, even if they didn't actually get land, were guaranteed security of tenure and rent controls were imposed on agricultural land, so they could farm some land and have reasonable security and hope to make a living. Those kinds of things were rolled back in the 1990s under pressure from the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, and with the approval of the United States government and apostles of neoliberalism like Tom Friedman, these policies were reversed, which means that millions, literally millions of Egyptian peasants went from being relatively secure farmers who could actually make a living from the plots of lands that they tilled to landless tenants who could be kicked off and, in fact, were kicked off in large numbers and ended up having to move to the cities in search of work at meager wages. Similarly, much of the public sector, in which a big chunk of the Egyptian population is employed, was privatized, in effect, at fire sale prices to cronies of Mubarak, but also people who continue to be close to the military junta now in charge of Egypt, even as wages were kept down by a trade union apparatus, which was controlled totally by the state. And any effort at worker protest in face of rising prices, in face of desperately difficult living conditions, was put down by force. So this is now an opportunity when literally millions of Egyptian workers see an opening to create their own independent trade union movement, to secure better conditions, and to create an Egypt in which these kinds of policies, which have immiserated much of the Egyptian population over the last couple of decades, will be reversed.
Fascinating thing about what you said is, we read a fair amount about all of this, and I would not say that the point that you're making has been made at all in the major newspapers. We look at it as much more of a political, quote, revolution, about democracy and a dictator and all this, and the attack on neoliberalism, the trade union base of the people in the streets is something that I don't think I've read almost anything about.
I don't like to talk about that stuff, Michael.
No, it's gotten very little attention. Again, I don't want to pick on poor Tom Friedman, but, he wrote all those columns about the heroic demonstrators in Tahrir Square, and that's nice. And the prevailing line has been this is a struggle for freedom and democracy. And, of course, it is. And one doesn't want to downplay the heroism of those young people who took to the streets on January 25th. But at the same time, What led to millions of Egyptians literally coming into the streets, and the very bloody battles in places we don't hear much about, like Suez, which is a working class town with tens of thousands of people who maintain and operate the Suez Canal, and textile centers and Alexandria and so on. They poured into the streets because for them the demand for democracy, the demand for freedom, the demand for the fall of the Mubarak regime was very obviously tied up with their hope for a better life. for a decent life for themselves and their children. The two can't be separated. So there's a powerful social and economic impetus to this for a lot of people, not for everyone, but for a lot of people, was crucial to their willingness to put themselves in line of fire to bring down the regime.
Let me ask you about the relationship of what's going on with the trade unions, with the people in the streets, to the military, and how you see that playing out. Because obviously they've had a very powerful military. It's close to the United States, at least the leadership is. They get over $1.3 billion a year from the United States. How is it going to be possible for really the continuation of what we've seen in Tahrir Square, what we've seen in Egypt, to continue with a military that is already, as you and I know, in deep meetings with the United States?
It's going to be difficult, and in a way, the hard part began the day after Mubarak was thrown overboard. Right, he was basically told to go by the generals, who I suspect hoped to preserve as much as they could of the old regime in the face of this popular uprising. The generals now running Egypt are products of the Mubarak regime. They were chosen by Mubarak. They certainly had no big differences with them. They were handsomely rewarded. The Egyptian military controls a pretty big chunk of the Egyptian economy, factories, shopping malls, residential developments, and so on. And at least the people at the top of the military have no desire whatsoever to give up their privileged status in Egypt. And of course, the danger is now that we will have the Mubarak regime without Mubarak, that there will be some cosmetic changes, there will be some greater political space, there will be elections, but that in institutions across the state, in factories, in universities, that essentially the old authoritarian regime, which is deeply rooted and has been around in some ways since 1952, will remain. The challenge for the popular movement, for the democratic movement, is to push this process forward, to make sure the generals can consolidate something which is Mubarakism without Mubarak, and that there's a truly democratic transition and opening for people, again, to pursue policies which will actually benefit the great majority of Egyptians.
Well, right now, Zach, you still have the emergency laws in place. You still have hundreds of political prisoners behind bars. You still have the formation of independent political parties illegal. You have no constituent assembly called yet. How do you think this is going to play out? And what are the steps forward for people with democratic-minded, egalitarian sentiments in Egypt?
Well, it's too early to tell. At this point, of course, the democratic movement continues to want to demonstrate that things have to move forward, right? So there are continuing demonstrations. The strikes are continuing. The military has repeatedly said the strikes should end, but basically they're being largely ignored by the workers. There is a new independent trade union federation being established and independent trade unions in different industries. So that will provide some kind of organizational framework. The people who launched this movement are very aware that there's been a very incomplete transition. They are continuing to demand a real, genuine transitional government that isn't staffed largely by cronies of Mubarak and people from the old regime. They want the dissolution of various elements of the security apparatus. They ultimately would like a new constitution rather than some fixes to the old one, although that may have to wait for a while. But we're in a period when these struggles are just beginning to unfold. We're waiting now to see what the committee appointed to amend the constitution to make possible relatively free elections will come up with. It should report back literally within days. And that will be a new arena of struggle. And people are beginning to form political parties. But this is a process which will unfold over the next weeks and months.
You're stressing what's happening internally in Egypt from an economic front, from a union front, from an internal democracy front, which is something that even Michael and I don't think really focus on. What we focused on, the first thing I focused on was what's going to happen to the Gaza border, what's going to happen to Palestine, what's going to happen externally in the foreign policy. How do you see that playing out as well from an Egyptian point of view? Because, of course, it's been, to put it mildly, a cooperator with the United States and Israel in keeping the Palestinians in their place.
Sure. Well, a lot of what happens with regard to Egypt's policies in the region, its place in the region and beyond, depends on what happens internally. If there is something that approaches a more democratic, a more representative government, that government will be less likely to take orders from Washington in the way that Mubarak was very happy to. So, for example, Egypt was, as we know, complicit with Israel in enforcing the blockade of Gaza. That would not have been possible without Mubarak's complicity and cooperation with Israel. That was a deeply unpopular policy in Egypt, and I think pretty much all the political forces in Egypt want that changed. They want Egypt to stop collaborating with Israel in that respect. So again, how the political struggle unfolds in Egypt will play an important role on what happens, you know, more broadly. Egypt for 20, 30 years has been sort of absent from the regional stage. You know, Egypt was the center of the Arab world for decades, and because it's been so closely linked to the United States, so much a client of the United States over the last couple of decades, it hasn't been able to play that role. Now, you know, its example inspired people across the Arab world and beyond, and it's poised, again, if there is something like a democratic transition that has some basis to it, some depth to it, to resume a place, to play a more independent role, to pursue Arab interests rather than the interests of the United States in the region.
Zach, my reaction to these developments and Michael's reaction was just to be absolutely elated that we thought that this could be a world-changing process, just say like the Russian Revolution was in 1917, or if Che Guevara had been successful in South America. But now you see this whole region from Morocco over to Saudi Arabia starting to get mobilized. Was your reaction the same as ours?
I think, like everybody who's been watching the region, we've been waiting for something like this for decades, literally, and in the case of Egypt, for 30 years. So it's an incredibly important moment. It certainly could be a historic turning point, again, depending how things shake out. A month ago, it was unimaginable that Hosni Mubarak would not be president of Egypt till he dropped dead, and that these kinds of popular struggles could erupt across the region and force regimes to make concessions and hopefully topple more of them. And shake up what has been a stagnant, autocratic order run by old guys with absolute power who believed, again, they would die in power, is amazing to behold. So already, you know, there have been very dramatic changes. There will be more before we're done. It opens up dramatic new possibilities on a world scale. Right? The fact that in Wisconsin people are upholding the example of the Egyptians is a pretty amazing turn of event for those of us who've followed the image of Arabs in this country over the last couple of decades.
Yeah, for me, actually, when I watched the Egyptians in Tahrir Square, I just thought to myself how that changes the images, the stereotypes that people have in this country of who's a member of the Islamic religion, who's an Arab. I mean, it just, you know, there you saw people who could have been in Times Square. And it was just, I think it's a fantastic moment just on that alone. Libya, you've given us a fairly precise summary of Egypt and what happened with neoliberalism and where the unions are and why some of that is occurring. But, of course, you can't say necessarily, the same thing for every country in the Middle East. So each one has its unique circumstances, is my guess. Maybe you should take us into Libya and tell us a little bit about what you see going on there.
Sure. I'm not an expert on Libya by any means, but one thing to be said is, as you say, each country is different. And although the example of Tunisia inspired the Egyptians and the example of Egypt inspired people well beyond across the Arab world and even in Iran, of course, there are important differences. You know, Egypt has had a legal system, has had a well-developed state apparatus for 150 years, right? Libya is a very different place, sparsely populated, a lot of oil money. Still very strong tribal components to people's identity, regional components. It's been dominated for 40 years by Muammar Gaddafi, a deeply quirky, odd character.
There was a period, I don't know if you went through it, I won't ask to embarrass you, and I don't know if I'll embarrass Michael, but there was a period that, I can't say I loved Gaddafi, but, he was a solid anti-Zionist for a period of time. He had set up a sort of social democratic state in the 70s when he had so much money for 3.5 million people that he was looked at by at least some people on the left, more than some probably, as at least he stood against the United States, stood against Israel. And so now to see him slaughtering people is a real shock to me, at least. But
he certainly got a lot of mileage out of his anti-imperialist stance. When he came to power, he saw Gamal Abdel Nasser as his great hero. And Nasser died shortly thereafter. And Gaddafi always said, "I am," and claimed to be inheriting the mantle of Nasser. But he was a sort of, Nasser as farce, in a sense. and deeply erratic.
Yes, exactly.
And although, again, claimed a lot of legitimacy on the basis of his anti-imperialist credentials, at home he basically set up an autocracy, and the state has been dominated by him and his sons and his family now for four decades. And a lot of Libyans, for many different reasons, you know, want change. They don't want to be dominated by this guy and his peculiar ways. The other piece of it, of course, is for the last 5-6 years, you know, Gaddafi's made his peace with the United States. The oil companies from the United States and elsewhere have poured in to make money out of Libya's oil sector. And you have a lot of unhappiness about that. And it's one of the reasons why we don't get such loud protests out of Washington about the kinds of things that Gaddafi's regime is doing to his own people, right? To use airplanes, right, to attack civil protesters in the streets is outrageous. But Obama's been relatively quiet on this question, and one wonders if the oil contracts have something to do with this.
Yeah, I more than wonder. Also, Libya is the main oil supplier to Italy, to France, to Germany, and I think that plays in on it also, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. The other day, the Italian foreign minister said, well, how could we tolerate the Islamic Emirate of Benghazi? As far as I can tell, the only person who used this term was Gaddafi's son in a very rambling address on Libyan state television, and it was his way of trying to discredit the opposition in Benghazi, which has seized control of the city and pretty much all of eastern Libya. And it was strange to see him picking up on the Libyan regime's effort to discredit the opposition, which clearly has a great deal of political support, whatever its exact political content, which is hard to say at this moment. That boogeyman of, again, the Islamic threat used to justify autocratic regimes, which has been used across the region, is still there. But, as we've seen in Egypt and elsewhere, it's time to put it aside.
One of the main players in the area that hasn't been in play yet is Saudi Arabia. What's your thinking about what might happen there?
Well, that's a great question, and that's really the key question, because since the 1970s, Saudi Arabia, which was on the defensive in the face of sort of more nationalist pan-Arab forces, asserted its influence, used its oil money to buy friends and intimidate enemies, and has been the bulwark of this conservative autocratic order in the region. Again, it's hard to say. Many of us have been waiting for the House of Saud to fall again for many decades. I think it's probably true that Saudi Arabia is more brittle than it looks. There are a lot of poor people in Saudi Arabia. There's a tremendous amount of resentment by the fact that this is the last refuge on earth of the notion of the divine right of kings, that it's run by a family which treats Saudi Arabia as its personal property and named the country after itself.
That's true.
and there's, there are basically no elections of any kind, no free press, no open politics, no unions, nothing. There are a lot of people in Saudi Arabia who are unhappy about this and don't want their lives dominated by this, collection of princes, and especially by the fact that this is a country with an overwhelmingly young population, which has different visions and aspirations, and is run by a bunch of guys in their mid-80s who are all ill and not all there, I suspect. So this is a situation that may be ripe for change as well.
Thank you so much, Professor Lachman from NYU. It's just been a pleasure to have you as our guest on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for being with us, Zach.
Glad to help out anytime.
Take it easy.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Talking to myself at night because I can't forget. and you're listening to Law and Disorder. If you like this kind of old folk music, check out Down Home Radio at downhomeradioshow.com.